I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. If a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? If a massacre takes place in Africa and there's no journalist there to record it, do the victims scream? The answer to both questions, unless you're an unbearable pedant, is yes. But in the case of Africa, while the screams are real, you probably won't know about them. Africa, particularly since the end of apartheid, has fallen off the news radar of most American and Western-based media. It's only when the Marines are poised off the coast of Liberia does it briefly get to the front page, and then it drifts quietly away. Why that should be is a puzzle that we're going to try and solve in this hour. We're talking about Africa and the news media, Connection listeners. The world is full of chaos, the stuff that makes the news. Do you expect more coverage on Africa, Darfur, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Chad, Zimbabwe? Many in the news business say Africa doesn't make the headlines because it simply doesn't affect the average Westerner. What criteria do you want your foreign news coverage based on? Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-TALK to join in the conversation. And we have a number of guests in this hour. Mark Doyle is World Affairs correspondent for the BBC. And before that, he was a BBC reporter in Africa for nearly 15 years, and he still travels to the region regularly. Michaela Wrong has been writing about Africa for over a decade. She was a reporter there for a number of organizations, including Reuters and the Financial Times. Her forthcoming book on Eritrea is called I Didn't Do It For You. And Jeffrey Nyarota is with me in the studio. He is the founder and editor of Zimbabwe's only independent daily newspaper, The Daily News, and we'll have to go into the past tense on that because it was closed down. It was shut down by Robert Mugabe last autumn. Hello to all of you.
Hello.
Hello. Okay.
Mark, let me turn to you first. Just quickly, what are some of the stories that you know of around the continent of Africa that simply aren't getting picked up in the Western media, and in particular in the American media?
Well, it's difficult for me to comment on the American media, but the media here in Britain and the BBC and the international arm of which I work for mainly on the radio and also sometimes on the television. Where do you start? I mean, there are very interesting and dramatic things happening all along the coast of West Africa. I mean, for example, there are UN peacekeeping forces now in Sierra Leone and in next door Liberia and in the country next door to that, Ivory Coast, which doesn't get very much coverage at all. We have seen a bit of coverage of Sudan recently, but there are stories throughout Africa, really, virtually any country that you could claim to mention. I could probably tell you something interesting about it.
Well, tell us something interesting about when you go to your editors and say, look, this is going on, and I need to go there and report.
Well, I have to be fair to my editors at the BBC in that we don't have the same problems that you do, perhaps, in the American media, and you were particularly talking about newspapers in your introduction there, that we don't have that problem, that the editors do tend to take the stories. They don't take as many stories as they do from other parts of the world. We don't have as many bureau in Africa as we do in other parts of the world. But I think at least the international arms of the BBC take a good stab at covering it.
How many bureaus do you think would adequately cover the continent?
Well, why shouldn't Africa have the same number of bureaus as European countries? I mean, I know it's probably fanciful to imagine it, but if you put the number of bureaus and the number of expatriate correspondents that there are in, say, in Europe into Africa, then you would get a lot more stories out of it. I mean, stories don't exist, as you also intimated in your introduction, they don't exist unless journalists are there to make them work. We have half a dozen major bureaus throughout Africa, and we also have local correspondents in virtually every country. And so, as I say, I think the BBC, to be fair, does take a good stab at covering Africa and does it perhaps better than most other international media. But I'm not here just to sell the BBC. We also don't do well enough.
Michaela Wrong, when you were working for the Financial Times, did you have a hard time selling certain stories?
Oh, definitely. And in fact, I was very lucky because my paper is one of the papers that takes Africa very seriously. But my stories would routinely appear in something that had a title on it, the Middle East and Africa page. And the fact was that if a suicide bomb went off in Israel, or in recent months, if I'd been doing that job, it would have been just about every day, you know, with events in Iraq, then my story simply wouldn't feature. And this was always a problem because the Middle East tended to be regarded as a more important story because in strategic terms, you could argue that it is. And so you were constantly kind of holding off on stories because you were sort of hoping that there would be a quiet day in the Middle East and then you would get your story in. And I think these are the kind of calculations that people working in Africa, trying to sell their story to Western editors on Western newspapers sitting back in London or in Washington, are constantly trying to make. They have to kind of beg and seduce and plead on behalf of these stories to squeeze them into the paper. You're always in the position of a supplicant. You are never getting editors on the line saying, you know, we absolutely have to have this. It's a very different relationship from what many journalists have with their editors.
Well, do the stories in Africa cut across the perceived interests of the Financial Times reader? Did that affect your ability to get things in the paper?
It did affect the ability in that, you know, in the area I was covering, which was sub-Saharan Africa, not including South Africa, for example, there was barely, I don't think there's a single company that was considered big enough or important enough to warrant regular coverage. So in a way, they were interested in Africa for the amount of trouble. You know, that's the way a financier would look at Africa, sort of instability, a source of trouble, a source of problems that might affect their businesses, that might spill over. And that would probably be the view they would take towards Africa, yes.
Right. Jeffrey Nyarota in the studio with me. Now, you've come from Zimbabwe under difficult circumstances. When you're sitting here in Boston over at Harvard, you spent the last year as a Nieman Fellow. When you read the papers, did you feel you were getting enough information about not only your own country, but just the continent?
My own view, after 18 months of reading American newspapers on a regular basis, is that Africa is grossly underreported, undercovered. I believe I'm not the only African who has this sense that we could benefit from more regular coverage, more detailed coverage of events on the continent. Unfortunately, this is not the case. Newspapers here, I'll speak about newspapers because I read newspapers very regularly, tend to highlight crises on the African continent. And in between crises, there is no coverage. Mark Doyle put his finger to the problem, I think. He says if all the bureaus in Europe, all the correspondents in Europe were translocated to Africa, Africa would get a much better coverage. And I think therein lies the problem. But he also makes a point that I think belies another problem. Because I think there's an assumption that Africa must be covered for the consumption of the outside world by foreign correspondents.
That's an interesting point. You bring up two there, Jeff. I mean, one, the question of resources, a lack of commitment of resources by Western media to Africa. And two, the idea that you have to have one of your own go out to Africa rather than hiring a local correspondent is probably perfectly capable of covering the story. But let me go back to the first bit, the question of resources. When Rwanda started to disintegrate, it was well on its way to the terrible place it got before it got any notice at all. And Mark, I think my memory is that you were the very first Western correspondent to get to Rwanda as the country collapsed into genocide.
Well, I was one of a relatively small group, and it's certainly true, and I was there for most of the genocide, unfortunately, or fortunately. But although I think it's true that the media did fail in the sense that the media didn't put Rwanda up there, and CNN and BBC television crews weren't there early enough, and so on. And when they did get there, they were covering a refugee crisis rather than the genocide itself, and so it was a big failure. I think that we should also, we shouldn't just, you know, be beating the media about this. It was a failure of governments, particularly the United States government and the British. And the French and the Belgians also take some blame in this. If they knew what was happening, and if they had wanted to do something, they would have done it. And I think that it's easy to blame the messenger when, in fact, those who are in power are responsible.
Mark, I don't think I'm blaming the messenger. Let's clarify the question. The question is, I think it's implied that if events are covered and fairly regularly and prominently displayed in the newspaper or, you know, in the running orders of our broadcast news programs, that what governments know and what journalists know then gets into the general public discussion. And it's through public pressure that you begin to find governments are more likely to get off the dime and maybe do something about it. And I always get the sense that certainly what happens with Africa in particular, and Jeff was saying it quite clearly, is that, boom, it's like there's a crisis, but the processes that go on between crises are just unknown.
I think that's true, and I apologize if I was sounding too defensive there, Michael, but I also think that it's true that in some ways journalists aren't the only people that set agendas. It's governments that set agendas. I mean, if you just look just at the European press, at the amount of coverage which we have of what happens in the United States and what President Bush has to say about a particular thing or what Colin Powell has to say about a particular crisis, that yes, of course, those guys are important people in the world, but it's also true that they have a very, very powerful propaganda machine which sort of rolls over to Europe and we pick up that agenda. So we're not just talking here about journalists' failure to do things. I think we are talking also about the global agenda and the power relationship between rich countries and poor countries. I don't think we can get away from that.
Michaela?
Yes, I would agree with your two previous speakers that, there are definitely agendas. I mean, if I think of the area that I'm interested in at the moment, which is Eritrea and Ethiopia, I think one of the areas where we're most likely to see a new war, and I desperately hope it won't reach that stage in the next year in Africa, is between Eritrea and Ethiopia. And I have tried to sell that story repeatedly to editors who regard it as a sort of eccentric obsession that I'm harboring. But one of the reasons that they don't really want to touch the story is because, of course, you know, no foreign ministry here in the West is talking about it, and everyone is gaily pretending that there's a problem, that there's no problem there, and everybody is embracing the Ethiopian government recognizing there's this problem there that has to be addressed.
Well, since the overthrow of the regime and the splitting of Ethiopia into two entities there, I mean, there's already been one major war. Surely you can go back and say they're at it again. Or what do people say to you when you try and sell this story?
They just sort of regard me as a sort of eccentric, sort of mad woman who has a sort of bee in my bonnet. And in the last 2-year war between the two countries, there were 70,000 people at least were killed, and hundreds of thousands of refugees who we, you know, the West in the form of the UN then ends up helping out in terms of food aid because the refugee exodus is so large in these kind of crises.
Michaela, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're coming up to the break. That's what the music means. We're talking about Africa, the media, their interrelationship, what you don't read. Does that affect why your governments don't act? What kind of foreign news coverage would you like to have more of, Connection listeners? 800-423-8255, 800-423-2255. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about Africa and the media, Western media, American media in particular, coverage of it. Is there a relationship, Connection listeners, between the amount of coverage of an area and your response to it, and through your response to it, the government's response to it? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call. I've been talking in the first segment with Mark Doyle of the BBC, Michaela Rong, formerly of the Financial Times, and with me in the studio, Jeffrey Nyarota, who was the founder and editor of Zimbabwe's only independent daily newspaper, The Daily News, until Robert Mugabe closed it down. Did you read about that, by the way, in your local paper? And now I'm joined by James Smith, who's the foreign editor of the Boston Globe, and he's down there at the Globe office here in Boston. Hello, James.
Michael, hi.
Hi. Now, you've been listening, and I hope you don't feel too beat up on here.
Not so far.
Okay. But, well, then let me ask you just some nuts and bolts questions. When the section editors sit down for the morning meeting and start divvying up the available space in the paper, does the foreign desk always have the same amount of space on any given day?
No, it varies. The space varies. It's driven by a number of factors. I mean, it's driven by the size of the paper. It's driven by competing demands. The Globe is a metropolitan paper. We're not a national newspaper. We devote a lot of attention to covering Boston well, the region, the country, and we take international coverage seriously, I like to think. So there are competing pressures from a number of directions.
Is it fair to try and quantify it by saying that on any given day, 10% or 12% of the available news space is foreign news?
Oh, I would say at least.
Then what is the percentage?
Well, I would certainly a quarter to a third of the A section of the paper.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to Africa, in this particular news period we're in, where I think the natural focus has to be on the Middle East, particularly on Iraq, as you draw up, do you have a daily thought on what are the triage, I guess, is what I'm getting to, about what should be in and what shouldn't be in?
Well, there certainly is an element of triage, given space and the constraints. At the same time, I would like to think that having listened to the and trying to reflect on the comments and the observations, that we, I've made a pretty significant effort to cover Africa well in the Globe over the last couple of years, even given the competing demands from Iraq.
How many Globe staffers are there in Africa?
Globally, the Globe has 6 staff correspondents abroad, which is a far smaller stable than the biggest, than the kind of the top 3 or 4 papers, the LA Times, Washington Post, New York Times, which have 20, 25 staff correspondents overseas, perhaps 30. So we're a smaller player. But given that, I think it's worth noting that the Globe has 1 staff correspondent in Europe, and we have 1 in Africa. We like many papers, have shifted the focus of our staff correspondents and also of the Stringer correspondents who we use regularly away from Europe, away from the First World over the last decade or 2 decades, very much and very consciously toward Third World coverage, toward the developing world. I mean, 5 of our 6 staff correspondents are in the Second and Third World.
The conflicts in Africa now, I mean, what is your view as an editor? And I'm just asking your opinion. If you have, I guess I'll assume you get memos from around the world from, correspondents, whether they're on staff or not, saying this is what's going on in my part of the world today. I think this is important. This is what we should be covering. You sit there and you're going to sift through them. Day in, day out, when you look at Africa, where do you think it slots in the priorities that your paper should have in its
coverage?
Well,
I hope I would never call one of my correspondents eccentric for pitching a piece on Eritrea or Ethiopia. How do I put this? I mean, given that there are the competing pressures, we are attempting to make sure that we are covering these issues. I think one point I wanted to make was that we've been talking about quantity of coverage, but I think the quality is equally important, perhaps more important. I mean, that part of the problem and part of my problem as an editor is that we are driven by crises and breaking news and dramatic events and tragedies, and that sometimes comes at the expense of our other responsibility, which is to explain what's happening and give background and context. And that is certainly a major focus for me in those morning news meetings and in the discussions with the correspondents, that we are looking for ways to find an issue that reflects, or a way to tell a story that will go beyond just the kind of the mechanics and talk about people and how people are suffering and how people are surviving.
Jim, go ahead.
This is Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jim.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. I'm a regular reader of your paper, and I find that its coverage of my continent, Africa, is maybe better than a lot of other newspapers that I read. And I agree with you that sometimes quality is better than quantity. But as an African who is away from the continent, I think we deserve more quantity so that we have an idea of what's happening over the continent. There are so many Africans in the United States. In Boston, there must be thousands. And these are people who have a yearning for information about their countries. And I must say that I do not believe that they get enough of that kind of coverage. You say you have one correspondent on the African continent. My guess is that he may be based in Johannesburg.
Correct.
Because many of the foreign correspondents are based in Johannesburg, and they cover the African Africa, sub-Saharan Africa from Johannesburg. And I think this underlies the problem that too much is expected of one foreign correspondent based in Johannesburg in terms of covering a whole continent, where a lot of dramatic news sometimes does happen, which is what they're expected to file back to their organizations, to their agencies, to their papers. But they fly to the crisis at the last minute, and they have no chance, they have no opportunity to acquaint themselves with background, with the context of the story before they're expected to file. And I think that is part of the problem. I know there are financial constraints that make it difficult to...
Michaela, was that you going...
Yes, I was going to say, it's something we haven't discussed so far, but I think the cost of covering Africa is a very important issue, and I'm sure the Boston Globe's editor would concur with that. It's one of the most expensive continents to cover, and I was constantly amazed at how much money I was asking my editors to spend on me, because...
Where does the expense lie?
Well, internal flights in Africa, because Africa is a continent that's not covered by many of the major airlines. And when they jack up their prices because they often have virtual monopolies on the routes. The flights are incredibly expensive. Then often you would be flying into areas where security at night was not great. You had to stay in a hotel where there would be an operating phone. That would mean you'd be spending $250 a night on a hotel. Often, if you're going to places where the phones weren't working at all, you would have to go in with a satellite phone. Nowadays, most people can afford their own satellite phone, but when I was first operating in Africa, you'd be talking about $20,000 worth of equipment. Then you'd have to have your own computer. Then you'd have to be hiring maybe a translator if you didn't speak the local language.
Jump right in, Philip.
If I may butt in, Michaela. I appreciate the point that you're raising, that of... the cost of covering Africa. But I want to propose that there is a very simple way around this problem, and I'm surprised that foreign news organizations have not thought about it themselves, which is the appointment of local journalists to cover their countries.
Jim, quickly, because the phone banks are lighting up. I'd just like you to respond back.
Can I make one point on that?
Michaela, no, because I've got a direct traffic now. I'm sorry. Jim, could I just bring you back in and ask you to respond to Jeff, please?
Well, I think Jeff is right. I would like to have... We don't do enough. And I think that probably every American editor would say that, and particularly about Africa, that we need to do better. I think that Michaela is also right that the obstacles are... are seriously obstacles, financial obstacles, the safety issues for correspondents, and also that governments in Africa often try to make your life miserable as a journalist. In Zimbabwe, as Jeff personally knows very well, is one of the worst examples. I mean, they won't let our correspondent in. They won't let most correspondents in. Sudan, it's very difficult to get into, and we have to work harder.
Jim, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your day to join us. And I'm going to say goodbye now. Thanks a lot.
Michael, thank you.
Jim Smith is the foreign editor of the Boston Globe. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tom is on the line from Toledo, Ohio.
Hi, thank you. I agree with one of your previous callers that we do need greater quantity of coverage, but I think there's another issue here, and that is the level of interest of the media consumer, because after all, the media is in the business of selling a product, and they depend on their customers to be interested in the product. And I think many people don't see Africa as being, especially in this country, as being relevant to their daily lives. And I wonder how, if it's possible, if reporters or need to do a better job of making a connection between Africa and the average media consumer.
Tom, thanks for that question. Mark, now you don't work for a commercial broadcaster, but the relevance question is actually a very important one, because most of the people, particularly in America and also in Britain that you're broadcasting to and around the world, won't have a detailed base knowledge of Africa. So how do you make it relevant to them?
Well, I think that's a very fair point, and coming from the United States, I think it's a reasonable thing to say. But in Europe, that isn't the case. I mean, Europe is right next door to Africa, and if you have crises in Africa, you do quickly see the results in terms of people applying for asylum, people, economic refugees, diseases spreading. There was a story just recently about a locust swarm in North Africa that was threatening to come to Spain, and surprise, surprise, it hit the news because the Spanish authorities were concerned about it and sent some planes to try and kill these locusts. But you know, we can't just be cynical about it. It's a fact that Africa is just across the Straits of Gibraltar, and that it does affect what happens here in Europe. But more generally speaking, how do you make things relevant to people? I think it depends how you write the stories and how good the quality of the journalists is that you've got, and how they can say that this is intrinsically interesting, even if it doesn't perhaps hit your pocket. It is intrinsically interesting.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Jeff, in absorbing the news on this side, are we pussyfooting around here about racism? That simply because this takes place in Africa, that things happen in Africa, there's less interest simply out of racism?
Mm-hmm. Your question, I think, ties up with the point that Mark was contributing to just now, that of interest and relevance, which I think I must say a little bit about. As editor of a newspaper, I've used three main yardsticks in deciding which stories to publish. Interest, the interest of the story to our readers, the relevance of any story to the readers, and the importance of that story. Now, I want to believe that for the American audience, relevance of events in Africa is not always easy to establish, neither is importance. But interest can be generated. If a newspaper publishes a story that is breaking and then does follow-up stories, publishes follow-up stories, the average reader will be interested in that story. I'll give an example. Newspapers here were full of the crisis in Liberia last year until the departure of Charles Taylor. Thereafter, nothing. I do not want to believe that, because some American editors tell me that readers are not interested in Africa. I'm sure if they were interested in Liberia during the crisis, they must be wondering, what is happening now in that country that we're reading about
Yeah,
let me to be brutally cynical. The Marines were there during the crisis, the U.S. Marines. There's more interest in Liberia, say, than when Sierra Leone went through ructions a couple of years ago, and it was British troops that were sent to calm the situation. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Hassan is calling from Boston.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I'd like to say thanks to Mark Doyle. I guess it's Mark Doyle from the BBC. He did a pretty much good job on covering the situation in Africa in the past couple of years. I'm a Liberian journalist, formerly editor-in-chief of the Analyst newspaper, and incarcerated for 6 months under the government of Charles Taylor. But I do agree that indeed there is a relationship between the way the media covers stories in Africa or other parts of the world and the way people respond to it in the West. They sort of try to bring pressure to bear on Western government to act. But more than that, I think they should be more interested, in fact, in what happens, as Jeff just said in the studio, what happens after the crisis. Western media are usually flooded with news about crisis in Liberia, I mean, in Africa. For example, in Liberia, I think if not much is reported on crisis in Africa, definitely the democracy that the Western world is seeking to build in Africa is not going to work. For example, the case of my country, Liberia, which had become a failed state under former President Charles Taylor, there was a situation where the Sierra Leone war was being fueled from Liberia through gun running and diamond smuggling. And this attracted Al-Qaeda members to begin to flood into Liberia to bring arms to Liberia, and then the Liberian government under Charles Taylor took those arms into Sierra Leone and exchanged for diamonds, and the diamonds were given to the Al-Qaeda members. So what I'm saying basically is that as long as the Western media is not, I'm not putting much attention on what's happening to Africa, certain things will not happen. For example, what...
Hassan, I've got to stop you there and just throw this quickly to Mark Doyle for a quick comment.
Well, I completely agree with what Hassan said, because the fact is that if you have journalists on the spot, then they will find the stories, and Liberia is a perfect example. I was there last year when all of the American networks, or most of them, even down to Fox News, had a correspondent waiting for the American Marines to come in, which they didn't do, of course, in the end. But Liberia is a very easy country to sell to America. It even looks like parts of the south of the United States. It would be very easy to get good stories out of Liberia almost all the time.
We're coming up to the break, Connection listeners. We're talking about Africa, the media's coverage of Africa. Is it relevant to you? Do you think, as citizens of the world's hyperpower, which is an empire, if you want to call it that, that you have a responsibility to know everything that goes on in the world? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK is the number to call. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking about Africa, Western media's ability to cover all the stories that go on there, and we're talking about it with Mark Doyle of the BBC, Michaela Wrong of the Financial Times, and Jeffrey Nyarota, who is the founder and editor of Zimbabwe's only independent daily newspaper, The Daily News. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Siddiqui is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was calling essentially to say that I believe that the what's really relevant here is what one of your guests said in terms of why there seems to be reluctance on the various media to, in fact, not hire locals to cover what's really going on. And I think that, you know, it's all part of a concerted plan that's gone on for decades, centuries, if you will, to portray Africa as the quote-unquote dot continent. We're talking about a continent that's made up of, I believe, about 54 countries. And all we hear about are the negatives that come out of Africa. You know, let's acknowledge the fact that there are some issues, but there are a lot of countries in Africa where things are going very well. You can go into metropolitan areas, make you think in some of the metropolitan areas here, but we never hear about that. And so I think that there's really a concerted effort, if you will, to portray Africa in a negative. Particularly, an example would be, say, when the Chinese launched something into outer space. If I'm Chinese living in this country, you know, I'm taking pride in that. But if I'm a young black man or black woman here, and all I hear about is negatives in Africa, then I'm not going to relate to my quote-unquote my homeland in a positive way. So I don't think that that's an accident, if you will. So I think it's just a continuation of ongoing policy.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, Michaela, please. Michaela,
Wrong. this issue has been raised a couple of times during this conversation, and I have quite strong views on this because I was working for Reuters in Congo next door to Rwanda when the genocide began. One of the reasons why the Rwandan genocide was quite badly covered in the beginning stages was because there were local stringers, as we call them in the trade, so Rwandan journalists who were supplying news to people like Reuters and the BBC. And some of those people, it turned out later, were actually members of the genocidal militia gangs who were chopping people down at the roadblocks. So they were sending not what you call exactly neutral news back to their headquarters. I had a similar problem in Congo Zaire, where I turned up to work as a stringer. And the reason that Reuters had wanted to get an outsider, a Westerner, whatever, just a non-Congolese, was because the person I was replacing happened to be one of Mobutu Sese Seko's most ardent supporters and was running a pro-Mobutu newspaper. Now, the point is that African journalists on the ground come under enormous pressures to earn their living. They are open to political pressures. They have strong political views of their own. They're often not capable financially or emotionally or for whatever reasons of being neutral players. And the reason that we're sent in is not necessarily because these organizations are racist Western organizations. It's partly because we don't have local agendas. We don't have families who can be threatened. We don't have salaries that can be cut by governments or offices that can be burnt down. We are protected from that kind of pressure that turns you from being a neutral, independent journalist into being a political player yourself. And that is really, we've had this issue raised repeatedly.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I don't disagree with everything that Michaela said there, but for every corrupt African journalist, which is what she's talking about, there are some extremely good ones. I mean, I attended a couple of the revolution in cell phones and FM radio stations, just in the electronic media, has had a huge impact on the growth of democracy in Africa. A couple of examples: the elections in Senegal and Ghana in the year 2000. They were reported by bilingual and trilingual local reporters on their cell phones from the polling stations, so that the governments couldn't cheat even if they wanted to, and they were broadcast direct on what are now relatively cheap FM radio stations. And I take my hat off to those African journalists who basically have contributed more to democracy than African politicians.
You guys over there in Britain, let me just stop for a second and let me ask Jeff in the studio quickly, because we've got a lot of calls. Just to come back to Michaela, because you're the man who's been hammering home the point that more locals should be hired in Africa.
Mm. I'm sorry if I can apologize if the journalists or some of the journalists in Rwanda failed to measure up to the standards expected of them. But Michaela says that these were stringers. They were not official correspondents of any organization. And the fact that they failed to perform adequately does not in any way mean that in other countries or even in their own country there are no journalists who can perform as well as foreign correspondents. And this issue of racism often arises from the selection of news applied by foreign correspondents. Outside my own country, Zimbabwe, as an example, where there was this land crisis. There's been this land crisis over the past year. Now, the thrust of the stories that have been filed from Zimbabwe by foreign correspondents has been mainly to do with the plight of the dispossessed white commercial farmers. Very little is reported about the plight of the farm workers, who far outnumber the farmers, and whose situation is in most cases far worse than that of the dispossessed white farmers. And they have no other home but Zimbabwe. But the coverage tends to highlight the plight of the white farmers. And this gives Mr. Mugabe an excuse to say, look at the foreign press. They are interested only in their kith and kin, thus undermining the good work that the foreign correspondents might be doing, because Mr. Mugabe is just dismissive. He says they're not interested in the issues of Zimbabwe. They are interested in the condition, in the plight of the white farmers.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Eric is calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, guys. I have a comment. I believe that part of the problem is our education here in the United States. We don't focus, once you're beyond Egypt in world history, there's no focus on Africa. We have our Western civilization courses and our American history through 1865 and beyond 1865, but there's no real, outside of those courses, we don't really touch on Africa. We talk about how they were drawn into World War I and the colonies and things like that, but we really aren't educated about it, and I think it's unfortunate, but I think that's a symptom of the problem. Perhaps that's why, as an earlier caller said, that the interest of the American consumer is not in Africa, and I would say that possibly that's because we're not educated about Africa, and if you don't know about it, you're not going to be interested in reading about it or learning about what's going on.
Okay, Eric, I'm going to take that comment and just pass it along this way to all of us, and just jump in first. As reporters, do we feel that we also have the function of educators, or do we report for people we presume are educated? Michaela.
I think your call is highlighting a very important problem. We don't suffer from it so much here in Britain or in Europe because of the colonial links. But there are two facts I would just point out. One is the war on terror, massive sort of obsession that's going to rule all our lives for the next 10 years. There are a lot of countries in Africa that have sizable Muslim populations. Nigeria actually has more Muslims living in it than Egypt. So that's one reason why we should all get educated. Another good reason to be educated if you're American is that the estimates are that in 10 years' time, 30% of America's oil is going to be coming from Africa. So that's another good reason that America should start looking at Africa with more informed eyes. But I know it's difficult to start when you're in a vacuum, but I'm afraid, you know, we have to start building the infrastructure there of an education.
Mark, when you're broadcasting, do you regard yourself as an educator as well? Do you accept that even with colonial links, people aren't going to have the proper building foundation for understanding what you're trying to explain?
Yeah, I'm not sure that the colonial links have that much influence anymore. You know, most African countries have been independent for longer now than they were under the tutelage of colonial powers in any sort of formal sense. So I'm not sure that makes that much of a difference. But I'd say that I would try not to, you know, be didactic and act as an educator. I'm a reporter, and the best thing that I can do is to find the best, most colourful stories that influence that affect people a lot, and tell them in as best a way as I can, either on the television or radio, and that's my job. And rather than being an educator, I think that would be almost arrogant to think I could do that.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Frederick is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to make a comment. I teach economics, and in economics we look at choices people make, choices societies make. And sure, I would love to see more coverage of Africa. I've lived in the U.S. for the past 15 years. I came from Uganda. But I got to admit that we haven't given the rest of the world too much to cheer about. And people, honestly, get tired of sad stories about bad governance and human long-suffering. And so instead of making excuses as to why we don't get covered more, my contention is at some point, Africans have to make a choice and say, we can do better, let's be doing better, and let's change the way the world perceives us. That's really my comment, and I'll be curious to see what your panel thinks,
okay.
And I'll be glad to take my comment off the air.
Thank you for calling, Frederick. I'm going to throw that straight to Jeff.
Fair question. I agree that maybe the time has arrived when Africans should set the agenda in terms of determining how the outside world perceives them. This links up with a point that I made earlier, that I see one of the problems with the coverage of Africa by the Western media as being that of over-reliance on correspondents assigned from New York, assigned from Boston, assigned from London. When there are journalists on the continent, notwithstanding the shoddy performance of the earlier cited journalists in Rwanda. There are journalists on the continent who could do a fair job of covering local issues with a full understanding of background, full understanding of context, full understanding of the relevant issues, which quite often the foreign correspondent does not have, especially if he has just arrived to cover a particular assignment, and especially if he is relying on interpreters. Michelle said earlier that one has to arrive and then arrange an interpreter. That alone suggests that the coverage that eventually comes out is not as efficient as would be the case if this were being done by somebody who is a local.
Mark, we're coming up to the end of the hour. Just quickly to respond to our caller from Virginia Beach and to pick up on Jeff's point.
Yeah, I mean, although I agree with the caller from Virginia Beach who says that it's time for Africans to sit up and do things for themselves, at the same time, I think this conversation is in danger of sort of implying that everything is irreparably awful in Africa. I mean, if anyone has visited Ghana, they just wouldn't recognize any of the things that are being described. It's a successful economy, things are going well, it's a democracy, they're building new roads, etc. I know that that's not the case with everywhere, but, I mean, how many people have visited, you know, the game parks of East Africa, the beaches of Sierra Leone, seen the wonderful things that the education department is doing with regard to the old castles in Ghana? I mean, there are lots of positive things that can be said, and I don't just say that out of any sort of sense of duty. I genuinely think that there are.
It's hard enough getting the bad news on. I mean, how do you get the good news into things, Michaela?
Well, I tend to be more downbeat than Mark. Doyle, I do think that Africa remains a marginalised continent. In fact, I think if you look at the economic statistics, it's slipping further and further behind the rest of the world. And when I go to most of the countries that I've been covering on a regular basis, I feel as though I'm going back into a time warp and that they simply aren't moving on, they aren't changing. And that would be fine if the rest of the world was also staying put, but it's not. So I think the chasm's growing greater and greater. So I agree with the Ugandan caller that we need to see a change in African leadership. There's been some really big disappointments on African leadership in the last 10 years.
Okay. Mark Doyle and Michaela Wrong in Britain, why don't you guys get together and have a coffee and talk this out, talk out your differences. Thank you both for joining us. Mark Doyle is World Affairs Correspondent for the BBC. Michaela Wrong is journalist, author of the forthcoming book on Eritrea, I Didn't Do It For You. And thanks also to Jeff Nairota, who is here with me in the studio, who will be a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard next year. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR.